Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, Episode 7.
Siete.
We've got a good episode today.
Yeah, Gypsy's really awesome.
Yeah, Lindsay and I spoke with circus director and auteur Gypsy Snyder. She grew up in San Francisco performing with her parents Larry Pizzoni and Peggy Snyder and her brother Lorenzo in their company, the Pickle Family Circus. She later went on to perform with Cirque du Soleil before being a founding member of the contemporary circus company Les Sept Doigts, or the Seven Fingers.
Oh, Les Sept de la Main.
Yeah, Les Sept Doigts de la Main. That's a seven.
We're really good at French.
Oh, yeah. Super fluent. She's directed numerous shows for the company, often with her longtime friend and co-founder, Shana Carroll. Gypsy's also worked on Broadway with her recent circus revival of Pippin.
Which was a great show. If you missed it, shame on you. We covered so many topics with Gypsy that we've decided to divide her interview into two episodes. Part two will be released later this week, probably Wednesday. Stay tuned. In this episode, we talk about growing up in the circus school in Europe, her first encounter with Cirque du Soleil, and how failure and negativity can actually drive your art.
In part two, we talk about her casting philosophy, act composition, circus education, and her upcoming show, Reversible.
If you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and rate us on iTunes. You can also email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. But don't make any comments about my nasally voice right now.
She's got a cold.
A really bad one. The show must go on.
Exactly. And with that, here's the episode.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Well, I want to start out talking about growing up in the circus and in Pickle Family Circus and sort of what that experience was like.
Well, in a way, I would have to say it's probably like the most idyllic childhood ever.
How old were you when you were on stage the first time?
I think, well, the first time that I kind of remember being in a performance zone was actually with the Pickle Family Jugglers before the Pickle Family Circus in Central Park. And I'm doing acrobatics with Larry, like him like holding me in his hands while they were street performing in Central Park. And in fact, we've just recently found some footage of them juggling, and it's like, what do you call that high eight film? Like the old
Super eight
yeah. film, silent, and they're juggling. And at one point, they drop the club, and this little blonde like runs on, grabs the club, and gives it back to them. And that was me.
Oh my God.
And I, yeah, I mean, we did that before the Pickles. So we founded the Pickles in 74. So that I was like 2 and 3 years old those summers that we came here and we lived in Chelsea. And I was in charge of counting the pennies after the performances when we would, like, pass the hat. I was in charge of pennies and subway tokens. And, I mean, I you know, I don't, is that really performing? No, but I did really get that we were, what we were doing was different from normal human beings.
So are you second generation or do your parents?
I consider myself second generation. And I mean, Larry would probably even say that we're third generation, even though his family had skipped a beat. His grandfather was a vaudevillian. And we have some of his old posters and pictures from him that you'll see in Humor Abuse, I think.
Oh, I can't wait for that to come out.
Yeah, I can't wait. He won't show me anything. He's shown me very, very small little clips. But yeah, so he would consider us third generation. So that was my first kind of realization that I was performing. It got more official when I was 4, and then, you know, I think Lorenzo and I were just kind of victims every year to, like, what did Larry want to do in the show? So there were years when we did more, and there were years when we did less.
Was there a point at which where you were like, I don't want to perform circus anymore when you were a kid?
Totally. My big rebellion was when I had to learn how to juggle, and I was maybe 7 or 8. And I remember going, like, I hate this. This is so stupid. Juggling is stupid. And you just want me to do it because you guys do it. And then I got it, and I was like, doomed. I don't know. Once you learn how to juggle, you're kind of doomed. And I wish I had never learned how, but I got obsessed with it and really followed in their footsteps. And I really juggled like my mom juggled. Like she had this really like female macho, like just pitching the clubs hard, and that was my thing.
Were you in school when you were doing all the circus, or were you
home? Yeah, that was the other kind of conflicting information. I think that my mom, being sort of a New England, very straight upbringing, really insisted that Lorenzo and I have standard education. And on the one hand, I really appreciate that now, and I actually have that for my children as well. I've insisted on that. But me being a little bit rebellious, it was really clear that in a normal school situation, I was really a freak. Mm-hmm. Just already my name. Like, I went to preschool. My mom dropped me off at this, my first day at preschool, and I was a little bit terrified. I remember being terrified. And then the story is, and I didn't know this, but the story is she came to pick me up. She said, "I'm here to get Gypsy." And they were like, "Gypsy, what are you talking about? There's no Gypsy here." And my mom's like panicking, "What are you talking about? I dropped my kid off here this morning." And then she sees me in the corner playing, and she's like, "That's Gypsy. That's my daughter." And she, "That's Susie." So I had already at like 3 or 4 figured out that we weren't normal, and that I needed to try and find a way to fit in to normal society. So I literally named myself Susie. After that, I read a Nancy Drew when I was like 7 or 8 and changed my name to Nancy. I was really leading two separate lives. Like, Gypsy wasn't cool. Circus wasn't cool. I was tired of people going like, "What's your name? Like, why?" Or, "Your parents do what?" And I mean, and circus wasn't cool either. That's the other thing, is like, the Pickles were cool in a hippie kind of underground circus way. And we went and saw every single mud show, sideshow, freak show, tented show. Like, Larry made us go to every single one. And those were my peers. But even with them, they were all Spangles and Stardust and really nice trailers. And so I felt like we were in this very unique world. And I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere.
Was there a point at which where you were like, "I do want to stay in this world, and I don't want to leave?
Yeah, really clear point, actually. And I guess my rebellion kind of went in two stages. Like, the first time was with the juggling, not wanting to juggle. And then we did the film Popeye. Robert Altman directed. It was Robin Williams' first movie. And Robert Altman hired all these circus performers. So it was us and Bill and Jeff and Michael Christensen. And who else was there? Javi Burgess, Judy Finelli, among others.
That's some amazing names.
Yeah, amazing names. Yeah. And even in like the acting world, if you look at the cast, Paul Dooley, I don't know if you know who he is. You'd have to like look at it and kind of like Google and go like, "Oh my God, he was in Sweet 16. Is that a movie? 16 Candles.
16 Candles.
they're all sort of everywhere. Robert Altman was an incredible man. And even at 10 years old, like, I got that. So we did that and I was like, "Fuck this circus thing. I want to be an actress." And I went back to San Francisco, and I was 10 years old, and I made my parents enroll me in the American Conservatory Theater, so ACT's youth program. And I was really convinced that I wanted to be an actress until, let's see, what happened? So I pulled myself out of the show one summer, and being in the audience, I just was like, "Oh my God. No, this is it. No, that's what I want to be doing." And then from that moment on, it was like I just wanted to do circus, but more theatrically.
What do you feel like the difference between being just an actress versus expressing yourself in the circus? How is that different for you?
Well, I really felt in theater that there were too many rules. And being a rebellious sort of being raised in the circus, there's not one way to think, especially in circus where each individual is so valued for what they bring individually.
And like celebrated for it.
And celebrated. And nobody else does what you do. Even, you know, and even between jugglers, there's not competition. You're inspired and you're never going to be like that other person. And even if I was talking to Eric Bates about being so inspired by Chris Cremo And that's like real, that's valid. And even if you wanted to do a gentleman juggling act, it would never be like Chris Cremo. So
I would love to see Eric Bates' version of a Chris Cremo act.
It's That'd gonna be happen. Awesome. He's promised. This is like years in the talking now. I'm sure it's gonna happen. So I guess I got into the acting thing, and I'll never forget this. Like, I went on a couple of TV auditions, and I was just utterly grossed out. Like, the competitiveness of it, or like, they're gonna pick her over me. Of course, like, auditioning, and I get the whole world, and it was just like a very violent reaction to an extent of like, I'm leaving this country. That, like, acting and wanting to be successful, these are my air quotes, successful in the United States. As a teenager, I was like the spirit of circus, and I had never been to Europe other than filming Popeye in Malta. I was like, I gotta leave this country. I'm never gonna be able to do like what the vision that I have in my head. It's not gonna happen.
Is that how you end up in Switzerland?
That's very much actually how I ended up in Switzerland, although there was a detour to the UK first. So, but to backtrack, the Switzerland thing happened. We ended up hiring Dimitri's daughter, Masha Dimitri. So David Dimitri was at Big Apple, and we were close with Big Apple in a kind of funny little competitive way, because Paul Binder and Larry Pizzoni, yes, I'm putting this on tape, they had a little like East Coast versus West Coast thing competition going on. Very different spirits, very different souls, very different goals, and yet, I don't know, there was always little alpha male thing going on there. And so David Dimitri was doing Tight Wire at Big Apple, and then sort of through that, then meeting Dimitri, Masha Dimitri came to do Slackwire at the Pickle Family Circus, and she's Swiss, Dimitri is Swiss, and I kind of saw her and the way that she approached circus and theater, and I was completely enamored of this woman. Like, she spoke six languages, she was very into dance and expression, and I mean, and her act was very traditional, although she put like flamenco dance in it, and she played clarinet, and she was just cool. She was just like the coolest thing I'd ever seen, and I would listen to her on the phone in the office talking to her family in Switzerland, going like Swiss German, like, what is that about? And I just wanted in. Then there was a detour. I graduated from high school, hadn't even applied to one college, and I could feel like the world shaking around me, like my mom just going, what the hell is going on? And I had applied to Chalon-sur-Marne, which was the school in France at the time. It was still there, actually. And I didn't get in because I was overweight. They said, lose 15 pounds and come back next year.
Is it a circus school or
a circus school? And that really, that hit me hard. And it was a real shock for me.
Did you have body images just before that? Or was that like sort of the first, your first take with that?
I think I did have body images, issues. Although in the circus, that's a little bit less of a reality. But the acting world kind of like
put acting
that
in.
And acting and dance put that kind of more where I was like, again, okay, I don't fit in. I'm not in a, so that, It was an issue, but it was more put a flame under me of like, I got to find my way to do this. Yeah. I've got to find my way. So after not getting into Chalon and going like, I need a ticket to Europe for like no reason. I mean, this is like pre-internet. This was just like, I know I don't belong here. I need to go there. And one of the board members of the Pickle Family Circus was also the founder of Electronic Arts, or is the founder of Electronic Arts.
Like the video game
maker? Like the video game maker.
Okay.
And he was on the board of the Pickles, and he's an incredible guy. And he was about to go move back to England to work on the European division of Electronic Arts. And they lost their nanny. And I had just graduated from high school. Barely graduated from high school, and he said, could you come and be our nanny for 2 weeks while we're getting ready to move to England? And I was like, sure. They had just had twins, just like a few weeks old. And I got, no, maybe a few months actually. But like, no, like a month and a half old. And I got
really little babies,
really cute, a boy and a girl. And they, after 1 week of being with them, they said, do you want to come to England with us? And I was like, cha-ching.
I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. There's my ticket to go. And I stayed, I worked for them for 6 months. And I, the only thing I asked of them is if I could have a week to go to Switzerland to audition for Dimitri's school. And I did. And I got in, and the Dimitri school was like everything to me. It was, you had acrobatics every day, you had juggling, manipulation, but it was not a circus school. It was a theater, physical theater school. And I just was like, this is, I really felt like Destiny's Child. I was like, this couldn't be more perfect. And I'm like in a little cobblestone village in the middle of nowhere, Ticino, Switzerland, speaking Italian and like doing theater all day. And what was funny was being, I was a porter in circus, so I was really like a refrigerator. I got there and I kind of remember like mentioning my issues to other classmates and they're like, what? You're incredible. You can do everything. And I was like, and I've landed.
I found my people.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really, truly that. And
it's funny how in hindsight, it's a blessing that you didn't get into the first school you applied to.
Oh my God, totally. And I actually think even prior, like even having weight issues, I kind of went, that guided me to the right place. It's like you can't take a negative and let it pull you back. You have to take a negative and push it forward. And I feel like that's kind of sort of inspirational talk in a crappy way, but it's really like, okay, this is hard. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Where does that help me to go where I want to go?
It's so easy to let the negative just be it and be fine, then I won't do it.
Exactly.
Well, like since we got on inspirational talk, I found an inspirational quote that you said that I want
to
ask you.
Oh yeah,
about.
Josh read it to me last night and was like, Gypsy said this amazing thing, and it is an amazing.
So the quote that you wrote or said and was on the internet was, no matter how hard things become, there is no failure. And I want to talk about the idea of you can't really fail because that idea doesn't really exist, or at least that's, you put that on yourself.
And you know where I first learned that? That was in improvisation. I'm an improv fiend. So at that school, that was at the Dimitri School, improvisation is kind of, at the time anyway, was the core of all theater. And then I sort of joined a group that was sort of an annex. It wasn't even part of the school, but it was like a guy who also lived there who started this improv group that wasn't improv comedy. It wasn't like competitive, like let's make the funniest cock-a-pee-pee joke thing at all. It was really just themes and situations that could go off like anywhere. Contemporary dance, like we did anything in these improvisations. And it was really, really clear that as soon as something went wrong, the improv got good. Mm-hmm. And it all of a sudden, like that fear of failing just sort of melted away. And I was 18 and I was like, oh, this is it. You can do no wrong. Because once you're in a bad situation, you're given something. You're given a gift, a challenge that is going to make you, no matter what, a deeper, richer person. And, you know, failure runs on so, so many levels. I hate tests. I panic. My younger daughter panics whenever she has a test because there's this finite right and wrong. And it's so hard to teach her to just be like, it's not about the right or the wrong. You can see her little mind going like, I don't understand, because if I do poorly, I do poorly. And you just have to somehow divert her focus to it being okay to just do it and try it, and it doesn't matter what grades you get. And yet at the same time, this is the catch, at the same time, failure connotates a kind of something that's negative. And I do believe that there's a certain amount of negativity. This is my new thing. That I do believe we need a certain amount of negativity to move forward and to fight for things. I think when, and this is something that I think our current society is a little bit ignoring, we're so focused on like everything being good and positive and, you know, the thumbs up on Facebook kind of thing, that I feel like people are ignoring the fact that we need a certain amount of rage.
Realness.
Mm-hmm. And I need to get angry about a subject in order to have something to say on stage. And that anger, I know, scares a lot of people, especially with me. I can be a very fierce person, very loving person, but I can be a very fierce person. And I need that to be creative. And I think that a lot of creative people now are kind of going like, well, I don't want to be negative, and I don't want to be dark, and I don't want to be an alcoholic smoking packs of cigarettes. Like, that's the art of the past. Like, that's what it was. That I just read something on Hemingway, and I was like, yeah, that's insanely destructive. And yet it's because his passion for life was deep, and there was anger and rage and his experience in war. Like, those are all things that, you know, if you're going to do art, you have to have something to say. And to have something to say, you can't just be like, woohoo.
It's so funny because I feel like I get really righteous about things and I feel very strongly about things. And it sometimes turns people off and they're like, I don't want to talk about something that's really important. Like, I don't want to say the wrong thing or make a comment on something that could offend people. And Josh and I was like, well, if you make a comment on something, like, you're going to offend someone. Mm. But it means you're actually, like, commenting on it and putting something out there that isn't just, like, a fluffy love story.
Yeah.
And to me, art moves, you know, the conversation forward and can be, like, such a great place for that.
For me, those sparks, it's a really tough one. And I actually think, to sort of bring it back to circus, I think that that negativity or explosiveness or rage can be really well handled in circus in an interesting way. And that's why Traces exists, actually, to be quite honest. Because you can filter the negativity and the aggression through, like, a physical reality. Like, circus hurts, and you sweat, and you bleed. And you bleed, and you're in pain, I can't believe I'm talking about Traces now, but that was like my way of encapsulating any kind of like aggression or pain, especially using like young performers who are really, really, really happy and haven't experienced any kind of traumas in their lives. How to create conflict on stage was to sort of physicalize that and take it to another level where you're not saying, you know, you're not getting into that conflicting conversation that you're talking about where, like, I'm going to tell you, like, this is how I feel, and I feel really strong about it, where people go, like, oh, okay, step back. Yeah, like, that's too much. We don't have a voice. I've done this test where I've written negative comments on Facebook, like, on my status, and it's the comments that will get zero reaction.
Negative things. Well, that's why BuzzFeed does so well. Their whole premise is that we'll go viral if you stay positive.
Yeah.
People want to like things that make them feel good.
And it fascinates me because I think I'm a very feel-good kind of person, but I like talking about the shit. Like, I like the dark stuff so much more.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like it's a Star Wars thing.
I love Star Wars. Oh my God. Do you think Kylo Ren is really good or bad?
Oh, geez, Manise. It's secular, obviously. I don't know.
Well, one thing I was reading, I think it was like you and Shayna talking about your approach to circus. And one thing that you guys we're talking about was this very thing of being able to say something through movement and like the picture and the image rather than needing to say exact words. And I think that's a really cool thing because, like you said, words are very specific and can make people uncomfortable, but the images.
Well, and words, because we all have very different experiences. So you know, you, we could have a conversation about Bernie Sanders, the three of us, and have really, really different opinions on it because we come from very different experiences. And I think this idea that each individual has this like incredible like lineage and experience that we have to somehow defend because we're all going to die and you want it to have some kind of value. Then when we compare that or we bounce that off someone else, no matter what, we're going to get to a point where there is a lack of communication. So if you create a piece of art that is going to speak to you one way and to your experience and allow you to interpret it your way and someone else to interpret it their way, then I feel like I've done my job.
Speaking of interpreting it, I think from at least my own childhood, the two shows that left the biggest impression on me were Drowlian and the original cast of Traces at New Vic, because it was the first time I'd seen contemporary circus, you know, the step past what Cirque du Soleil was doing.
Did you say Drowlian?
I saw Drowlian. You know, that was the first show that
obsessed with circus.
Okay, we got to talk about Drowlian after, but anyway, go.
Okay, I want to hear the Drowlian story is, but it was so amazing because I was such an angsty, unhappy teenager, and all I wanted to do at Smirkus all
like
year
Gypsy
round.
Like Gypsy was saying, it was like you didn't fit in, or because circus, you just wanted to be a circus person. And
yeah, I did, but I also, you know, when I saw Cirque du Soleil, I didn't relate to the people I saw on the stage because they had so much makeup on, and I was like, well, they're all ex-Olympic gymnasts.
Yeah.
And I was seeing, like, it was five people or six people, the original version, and I was like, oh my god, that's the thing. You know, like, that's me on stage, even though, like, I was probably only doing the Quebec handspring and wasn't very good and never going to do that, but it was, you know, I don't know what anger or things you were expressing, but for me, I was like, this is my teenage angst, like, right here on stage through circus.
So many people have said that. It's amazing. It blows my mind.
What's the Drowlian story, though?
Well, as a kid, someone had gone to China, and it was someone from the Pickles, and they brought back a Diabolo. And I still have it. It was one of those Diabolos that, like, it's cut so it makes the wind makes it whistle, which is like the old one. It had like bamboo sticks and everything. And I had like a little Mao Zedong outfit and a little red book. And it was an awesome gift. And I really got kind of obsessed with Chinese circus at a young age. And there was a couple troupes that came through, and we would always, of course, go see them. And I got... This is like, I was such a weird teenager, but I was really into the Cultural Revolution and the green and the red and everything, just like aesthetically. And like, I didn't get it. I didn't understand what it was, but there was, you know, I think when you love dance or circus or theater, and then you see someone like these Chinese doing this thing that is so extreme and so ancestral, like it was, you're witnessing circus in like its oldest form to this day. And so I was kind of obsessed with it. And then I really wanted to do an all Chinese show, like for years I wanted. And especially we had Lu Yi came to San Francisco, and I was like, I am so gonna do this. And it's gonna be about the Cultural Revolution, and there's gonna be like all these Chinese smoking cigarettes on stage and playing mahjong and singing like weird Chinese songs and doing circus. I was just obsessed with this show that I was gonna do. And then I found out that Cirque was doing an all Chinese show before it had been created. And I was like, no!
No!
And they're gonna because it was also, I think the first show after Franco, is that possible? I can't remember, but I think it was the first show after Franco Jagang. So we were still in the Franco world, where Franco's specialty, huge influence on the Seven Fingers, was really bringing out the best in his circus performers and using the Russians with their passion and using the Chinese with their ethereal beauty. So in my mind, what was going to happen was Cirque du Soleil was going to take these Chinese and just make them everything my fantasy was. And I went and saw it, and I was like, oh, no, I'm fine. I still get to do my show. This is not what it is at all. And I mean, you know, like putting the Chinese in African outfits to do hoop diving, I was like, what? And then Earth, Wind, and Fire, wasn't that it? The theme?
Yeah, the elements.
Yeah. And I just was like, come on, come on, we can't do the elements. And that was, it was for me, Drallion and was the beginning of the end, actually. Yeah. It was where, like, let's take pretty colors and a very large theme and not talk about real things anymore. Because, and that was directed by Guy Caron, who did the first Cirque shows that were really about what circus does to the human spirit. And it was very theatrical. It was all these, like, little mask characters, fat, normal tourists who would show up on stage, and one by one they would be transformed into beautiful circus performers, which seems kind of silly now, but it worked. I mean, it was the essence of why circus is theatrical.
Was Saltimbanco your first interaction with Cirque du Soleil?
No, I did a very weird Cirque detour. Cirque took over Pomp, Duck, and Circumstance in Germany. It had gone bankrupt, I believe, and Guy Laliberté was good friends with Heinz. Oh my god, he's gonna kill me. I can't remember his name. Anyway, the owner, the director, the head chef of Pomp Duck. They were good friends. So Guy said, I'm gonna bring it back into its glory. And he brought in directors, Gilles Saint-Croix, and a team of performers from around the world. And I was one of those performers.
What were you doing when you were in the circus at this point? Like, what did you call your act?
Yeah, I was just about to ask.
Okay. So there you have it. That's the question. I would have said at that time that my specialty was hand-to-hand.
As a bass?
As a bass. And I worked so with a girl. So badass. And I had had in my, from 14 to 21, I had three different performing partners. And I did about 3 years with each of them. And I dumped them all. This is so horrible, especially the first girl that I worked with, who was like my, practically my daughter, best person ever that I still love so much. And I left her, she was 8 or 9 when I left, maybe 10. And it was because I needed more. I was on this mission, and I loved hand to hand and I loved working with a partner, but I'm like this where it wasn't that I got bored or frustrated. I was just like, what we're attaining is great, but I it's not about the act. It's not about learning this discipline for me. There's something else that I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly sacrificing myself as a performer because I the form needed to be more for me, and like just creating a good act and doing it. So the act got to a certain level, and then I just moved on. And then I met another girl. And I was a good porter, and so we learned stuff, and the coach in Switzerland put us together, and I was like tossing her everywhere, and we did an act for 3 years, and then I was like, I can't run off and invest in this with you because I'm just on this, I don't know, I'm on this journey. So I went through three different people, and then when I got I had a contract at Monty with my last hand-to-hand porter, hadn't signed the contract, and got the offer for Pomp Duck. And as a character, like a character, not even doing circus. And I just was like, and I'm out of here. And I'd been in Switzerland for 6 years too. So it was time. It was definitely time for me to go. I was really feeling like artistically limited there. And getting the call from Cirque was, let's go. And then I did that for a year and wasn't fulfilled either doing that. That was very like cabaret character, brutal, like getting 50 mark notes in my bra during the show, and we would hand out free cigarettes to the audience through the whole show. There was smoking in the tent the entire time.
Oh man, that's a different time.
Different time. Yeah. There was a table reserved for a guy who owned all the sex phone numbers, like the 1980 Fick mich kind of crazy. I don't know if you've ever been to Germany, but it's like sex phone conversation, whatever. I don't even know, whatever. So there was a table. The guy who owned all those phone numbers had this table, and he would have just like prostitutes at the table all the time. And he would, after the show, would take us all to one of his brothels and like to go have drinks. And it was, oh my God, that was a crazy year. Really educational. Met my future now ex-husband.
At the brothel.
at the brothel. No, in the show, although he loved the brothels. I mean, it was an incredible cultural experience. Like, it wasn't as debaucherous. Our company, our troupe at Pump Deck wasn't that debaucherous, but to live and to get a glimpse of that world was fascinating. Especially, you go, the historical importance of German cabaret from, like, literally cabaret, the significance of a political climate that begs people to come to that kind of a venue and have that kind of an experience. You know, and of course, this was what, in the 90s, I don't even remember who was president of the United States or Germany at that point, but there was no real political climate that would call for this, and yet it was all these businessmen and people just desperately looking for more from life, like mm-hmm. some kind of validation for living or enjoying or experiencing something more than your humdrum life. So for me, it was a real educational experience, not only a glimpse into that world and the core of that world, like really old school German cabaret, but also realizing, you know, why circus is valid and why we go there. And I would, you know, audience members would come up to us after the show and just want to eat us alive. Like maybe literally, I don't know, but this feeling of like their humdrum lives, and this was the adventure. And I was like, this is so crazy because my life is an adventure, and I'm not restricted to one thing. And these people so are, they're so raised with walls that, you know, and they're free and they're happy, and maybe they're rich, maybe they're not, maybe they're happily married, maybe they're not happily married, but I'm talking about a kind of a human idea of how life is supposed to be lived. And I was never taught that. So to experience that on such an extreme level every night, that people were going to pay so much money to smoke and drink and be close. I mean, literally the idea with these cabarets was like you were close to all the things that you're not allowed to have in your real life. And it was so black, like so thrown in your face, that it's like, oh my God, okay, so this is our thing. Like, this is what we do. It almost felt like prostitution a lot. And yet at the same time, it also feels like, oh yeah, we're there to like open windows in these people's souls. And that's a good mission.
Yeah, it's funny. You talk about that, it reminds me of when I was at the Box, right as it opened, and I was like, I did that from 18 to 20, basically, right as the Box opened in New York and in London. Similar kind of crowd. And the idea of like, you are their fantasy, and then when you realize like, oh, you represent their fantasy, and you are very much aware that like it's just your job, that your perspective on going out to nightclubs, going out and drinking, just the idea of what is like fun in air quotes, is sort of shattered in a good way, I think, but in a way.
Also in a sad way. I mean, in a good way and in a sad way. I mean, I think it can be a very constructive thing. I am fascinated because there's such a resurgence, or maybe it's the first. Maybe the Box has like started this world here. I mean, I guess.
But I mean, they were going for like a 1940s German cabaret as the theme. We were heading towards Saltimbanco.
Okay. Oh yes, Saltimbanco. So then, at one point, Gilles Sainte-Croix, the director of Pump Deck, came, and I guess it was like contract renegotiations or something. And I said, this is not where I'm supposed to be. God, I was such a ballsy girl. I really miss being on the road. I really miss circus. This is too the other... What I was doing in the show was too much the other direction. And 2 weeks later, I got a call, like, come to Saltimbanco. And I was like, to do what? Like, and I was basically a porter and character. It was a little vague. And I said, like, why did you put me here? Why this? And he said, you're the perfect spirit for this show. And I was like, wow. He's an incredible man. And actually, we just had a meeting with him not long ago. One of the real souls at Cirque du Soleil. And he's not there anymore, obviously. But when you think about Cirque du Soleil and its glory days, I just really had a... a flash on to what extent Gilles Sainte-Croix was a very important part of that. But anyway, so he brought me to Salton Banco, and again, I was really just like a character, much more physical, obviously, than in a cabaret, but I, without being told, I just like showed up for Russian swing rehearsals training because I was only in the acting and dance sections and I was learning all the tracks. I was going to be like covering every single track in the show. And so I just started coming to training because I love training. And there was a Polish coach and he put me right in there, and I ended up being the first girl to catch a four high from Russian swing at Cirque du Soleil.
Man, it seems like that Salting Banco cast had like a bunch of really amazing people, sort of like the Pickle family, who like went on after that to do awesome things. Like, was where Elsie and Serenity and Bill in that version?
Elsie, Serenity, Bill were there.
Who
Sam,
run NECA now.
Who own NECA and run NECA now. Then there, and were San Franciscans. Like, I'd known them from San Francisco, although they came to San Francisco sort of after I left. There was Sam and Sandra. Sam Payne, they did the duo tango that like won gold.
Oh, yeah.
Paris or Monte Carlo, vertical tango.
Yeah, yeah.
So Sam was also through the school in San Francisco and a student of Lu Yi. Sandra Foisy, who's also now teaching at NECA, she was my classmate at Dimitri. So Sam and Sandra, Bill and Serenity and Elsie and I, Shana Carroll, Sebastian Solodivida, Shana's husband, now one of the Fingers, who was also one of the Fingers, was on Salton Banco. His hand-to-hand partner, Mimi, they won gold doing hand-to-hand in Paris.
That is, I have to talk about this act for a second. Because when I met Josh at Columbia for grad school, he was like, I do circus. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I'm not supposed to. I got the note that I shouldn't swear from my dad.
Oh.
So I was like, and his dad. Like, you shouldn't swear, Lindsay. You can let the guests swear, but you shouldn't swear.
Oh, because
I was like,
sweet.
What is circus?
Yeah.
All I knew was, you know, Ringling, Big Apple, and not really maybe Cirque du Soleil. And he was like, I'll show you. Because I showed him, like, I think a So You Think You Can Dance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, this is so awesome. And he was like, you haven't seen anything. It was like, you know, kind of like a hand-to-hand dance. And he showed me that act.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, I get it. Like, I get what you're saying. I get all these, like, movement that you can't get in other disciplines. Mm. And you posted that act, I think, recently on Facebook. And I was like, that's the act that got me into understanding what circus can be and like tell and evoke, and it's just like an amazing act.
It is an amazing act, and Seb and Mimi are incredible. Shana choreographed it, and it's really like the I think it's the so much the essence of what the Seven Fingers are, this idea of like very ever so subtly. And I think the things that people don't even notice about the act, and I don't even know if it's on the video that's on YouTube, but like Mimi comes in onto the stage and she's got her heels in her hand and she tosses her high heels, and like it's like the end of the night and something's supposed to happen and it's not gonna there's so much theatricality in it.
Yeah, storytelling. When he's like dragging her across the ground as well. Like levels to that act.
So much.
I hope you enjoyed part one of the episode with Gypsy Snyder. Make sure to listen to part two, because we talk about her life raising her kids, teaching in circus school, and we find out what she would want to be doing if she wasn't in the circus.
If you enjoyed the episode, please go on Facebook, like us, Twitter, tweet us, share us on Instagram, download us on iTunes, and subscribe. Thanks so much. We'll see you on Wednesday.
Twitter, tweet us.
Oh, we'll hear you. You'll hear us on Wednesday.
Twitter, tweet us.